This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
A primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbi, gay, and transgender identity. This is Queer Voices.
Good evening. This is Jack Belinsky.
This is Brian Levinka.
I'm Deborah Bell.
I'm Brian Erickson.
And I'm Glenn Holt. And in our second hour tonight, J.D. Doyle's Queer Music Heritage. This month, featuring singer-songwriter Kristen Hoffman, his music, his career, and his involvement with the Mumps and Klaus Naomi. In this hour, Joan Devlin talks with Judy Reeves about her first novel, The Pieces from a Heart, But She Didn't Have a Clue. And a somewhat autobiographical book set in Houston and featuring local personalities and this radio station. But first, news wrap from This Way Out.
Out.
I'm John Beaupre.
And I'm Donna Ann Ward.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending April 26, 2008. In a case that further legitimizes the legal status of families headed by same-gender couples in Israel, the Interior Ministry has approved a gay male couple's adoption of a now 8-year-old Cambodian boy and also granted the child Israeli citizenship. The adoption had already been approved in the U.S. to the two men who hold dual U.S.-Israeli citizenship. Until now, however, their son had only been issued an annual temporary residency visa in Israel because the country wouldn't recognize his two-dad family. One of them, who preferred that his name not be used, told the Haaretz newspaper that, "We had a problem entering and leaving the country, registering for school, at the dental clinic. They always ask what our relation is to the boy because he is not listed on our identity cards." The decision follows an earlier declaration by Israel's Attorney General Menachem Mazuz that adoption should be open to same-gender couples in the proper circumstances and when it is in the best interest of the child. That followed a high court edict that adoptions by same-gender couples granted in other countries must also be honored in Israel. The couple's lawyer, Irit Rosenblum, said a senior deputy state prosecutor wrote to her in early April, advising that the Interior Ministry had decided to recognize the adoption in view of the special circumstances of the case in question and the long time the minor has resided in Israel legally. She told the newspaper that, "The meaning of the decision is clear. The state directly and fully recognizes same-sex couples as parents, akin to heterosexual couples, who can adopt a child overseas and register without constraints as his parents." Mike Hamill, who chairs the Israeli Gay, Lesbian, Bisexual, and Transgender Association, told Haaretz that, "In recent months, we have been witness to the fact that heterosexual parenting is no guarantee for successful parenting."
Another gay male couple has won a landmark parenting case, this time in the Australian state of New South Wales. After their application to become foster parents was rejected by a welfare agency with ties to the Uniting Church, the Administrative Decisions Tribunal ruled that the couple had been unlawfully discriminated against on the grounds of homosexuality. Based on its religious affiliation, the agency unsuccessfully argued that it was exempt from the Anti-Discrimination Act, which bans bias in the provision of services based on sexual orientation or marital status. But concluding that the couple had been deeply hurt, insulted, and embarrassed, the tribunal awarded damages of $5,000 to each man. It refused the couple's demand for a public apology, but did order the welfare agency to review its policy on lesbi gay foster carers and take all necessary steps to eliminate unlawful discrimination on the grounds of homosexuality in the facilitation and provision of its foster care services. A spokesperson for New South Wales Attorney General John Hatzis-Stergos, whose government is said to be considering a series of reforms to improve the legal status of families headed by same-gender couples, told reporters that the period during which this case could be appealed by either party has not expired and it would be inappropriate to comment.
Elsewhere in Australia, 62-year-old veteran Melbourne TV anchorman Peter Hitchener came out as a gay man in an April 6th interview with the Sunday Herald Sun. "I just also need to say I am still the person I was yesterday," he noted, "and I remain committed to my job and my family and my service," and so on. Hitchener's boss at National 9 News, Michael Venus, applauded the move. "I am acutely aware of how difficult a decision this has been for Peter," he told the newspaper, "but it is a decision which has our full support and in no way diminishes his standing as one of Australia's preeminent broadcasters."
In other news, several enlistees who were discharged from the U.S. Armed Forces under the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy banning military service by openly lesbian gay personnel are expressing anger that recruiters have been admitting ex-felons to fill the ranks. The data, released this week by the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee, reveals that the 249 Army felony waivers in 2006 more than doubled to 511 in 2007. The Army waivers included three soldiers who had been convicted of manslaughter, one convicted of kidnapping, 11 convicted of arson, 142 convicted of burglary, 3 convicted of making terrorist threats, 7 convicted of sexual assault, and 3 convicted of indecent acts with children. Felony waivers granted to Marine Corps enlistees rose from 208 to 350 in the same period. The Pentagon discharged about 700 service members solely because of their sexual orientation in 2006 under Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Heather Sarver, a former Russian linguist in the Air Force who was discharged in 2003, complained to the Washington Blade LGBT newspaper that they'd rather have a convicted felon in the military than a gay person in the military, which is really just twisted, I think. Jason Knight, discharged from the Navy last year, called it outrageous. They're still clinging to this. It's going to hurt morale and cohesion. But what about letting convicted felons in, he asked. Is that not going to hurt morale and cohesion? Nathaniel Frank, a senior fellow at the Palm Center at the University of California, which has been trying to draw attention to the felony waiver information, said the data makes it clear that the military's ranks are stretched thin and that the Pentagon didn't anticipate entrenched warfare in Iraq and Afghanistan. He told the Blade that his group has conducted studies showing that ex-felons are somewhat more at risk for behavioral problems during military service. The situation, he said, is exacerbated by the fact that gay and lesbian troops that are ready and willing to serve are being kicked out for something that has nothing to do with their ability to perform.
Other researchers are reporting that sexual bullying in U.S. schools, harassment based on sexual orientation or gender identity, does more harm than other forms of such abuse. Writing about their study in the April 24th issue of New Scientist, James Gruber at the University of Michigan in Dearborn and Susan Finneran at the University of Southern Maine in Portland say they surveyed 522 children between the ages of 11 and 18, asking how often since the beginning of the school year each had been the butt of a sexual joke, been called names like fag or dyke, or been physically assaulted in connection with that type of bullying. 52% reported having been bullied and 35% had been victims of sexual bullying. Gruber and Finneran also asked questions designed to assess each respondent's self-esteem and physical and mental health. Not surprisingly, girls and sexual minorities, gays, lesbians, and bisexuals, were more likely than heterosexual kids to be targeted and were more likely to suffer serious emotional consequences. Gruber thinks that sexual harassment causes greater harm to children than other forms of bullying because it attacks what he calls their core identities as gendered people in a way that being called fat or stupid does not. Interestingly, the report notes, while sexual harassment is illegal in the U.S., schools are required by law to take action, bullying is not. There's an eagerness to label such behavior as bullying because it avoids legal hassles, said Gruber. But he calls that misguided and charges that an important health concern in U.S. schools is being ignored.
Meanwhile, according to its sponsoring organization, GLSEN, the Gay, Lesbian, and Straight Education Network, a record number of students from more than 7,300 middle and high schools across the U.S. took vows of silence on April 25th during the 12th annual National Day of Silence. Hundreds of thousands of students registered for the event online, including those from more than 1,000 colleges and universities. Participants don't speak during the day, handing out cards explaining that anti-LGBT bullying and harassment silences too many of their peers, and that it's time to break the silence. This year's event specifically honored Lawrence King, a 15-year-old from Oxnard, California, who, because of his sexual orientation and gender expression, was shot to death in February by a fellow student in a computer classroom. Breaking the silence discussion groups, assemblies, and rallies concluded the day in several locales. Various right-wing groups sponsored a small number of counter-protests, oxymoronically called a Day of Truth.
And finally, a 7-month kissing ban between two gay teen characters on the U.S. soap opera As the World Turns was lifted this week as Luke and Noah, affectionately referred to by fans as Nuke, finally shared another smooch. There had been no display of such affection since their first on-screen lip locks in late September, prompting queer fans to mail bags of Hershey's Kisses to the show's production office and maintain an online counter of how many days had elapsed since those initial smooches. Not everyone is happy now, of course. The notoriously anti-queer Tupelo, Mississippi-based American Family Association called on its members to complain to Procter & Gamble, the show's sponsor, whose products include laundry, soap, toothpaste, and disposable baby diapers. The group's online action alert condemned the show's latest explicit open-mouth homosexual kissing, but nevertheless provided a link to a video clip, warning readers, however, about its repulsive content. For the record, according to that online fan counter, the gap between those kisses on As the World Turns spanned 211 days, 14 hours, 45 minutes, and 45 seconds.
That's News Wrap for the week ending April 26, 2008, written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm John Beaupre.
And I'm Donna Ann Ward.
Mark Waggle, What I Like About You. This is Queer Voices.
And welcome. We have with us a very special guest to Queer Voices, not a guest to KPFT, because she's frequently heard on After Hours, Judy Reeves. And Judy has written a book called... Say the name of the book, because I did it wrong.
The Pieces Form a Heart. but she didn't have a clue.
And boy, no truer words were ever spoken, because I've often heard people say, that Judy Reeves, she doesn't have a clue. But there was a reason for that. And Joan Devlin, both Joan and I have read Judy's book, and Joan we invited to do the interview because she's the most excellent book interviewer in the world. So, Joan, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
From
and
the
I
fields
have to say,
of Iowa.
Judy, I have a whole new respect for you. Wow. Yeah.
Well, thank you.
Well, I'm just going to sit here and lend moral support and let you take over, Joan.
Okay.
And
first of all, I think we have until
8:35.
Okay, great. Because there is a lot of ground to cover in Judy's book, and it's, you know, the book is 200 pages long, and, I mean, it's amazing what you've been able to work into that 200 pages.
I write small.
And I have to say, too, that, you know, the dedication in the front of the book to the individuals that inspire you, as you go through the book, you know, which is unusual because most times books are dedicated to people that you never hear mentioned in the book. But in this case, as you go through the book, you can understand why those individuals were acknowledged. You have had quite the struggle. I mean, the book starts out with you virtually escaping from a long-term, very abusive relationship with a woman that works in the same place you work, and even after you've left her, continues to basically steal money from you, threaten you, and just make your life living hell.
Stalk is the word.
Yeah. It's crazy. How did you get through that?
With the three people that the book is dedicated to, really. They were literally the lifeline. And they're all still in my life and probably will be, I hope, for the rest of my life. Is that true over there in the corner? Okay, we have, you know, an audience participant here that's sharing this with me. And Deborah.
So how, you know, at that point in your life, you know, you were just literally, I mean, escape is the right word. You were escaping.
Yeah, literally, yeah, with the clothes on my back.
And, you know, what was kind of the turning point for you? Could you kind of go over that with the audience a little bit?
Well, the turning point for leaving was actually a fight that involved a weapon at the house. And prior to that, for about the last two or three weeks before that date, there had been heated arguments we were involved with the NAMES project that was making its first national tour, and it was coming to Houston. So it was quite a heated argument every time that would draw my attention, which I might have to say that was attention that she wanted drawn. She involved me in the NAMES project. I didn't just jump in there and do it because I wanted to.
But to interject here, it was no small involvement. Judy was the volunteer coordinator for the Houston display.
Yeah.
Which, having seen the debut of the NAMES project when it first was shown in 87 mm-hmm. in Washington, D.C., it was the Houston display that affected me the most because, of course, that were the people I was closest to.
Right. And the Houston display had the advantage over any other place where the quilt went that year in that, as they read the names, those were the actual panels our volunteers were unfolding.
And you were the volunteer coordinator.
And I was the volunteer coordinator, and they danced around that George R. Brown like you wouldn't believe. It was a dance. It was more than just unfolding. And people loved it. The people from San Francisco went nuts over it. But that drew so much of my time and attention that it caused a lot of stress at home. And ultimately, actually, I probably shouldn't say this, but the weekend the quilt was here was actually a birthday weekend in our house. And so it kind of got smoothed over, too. So a combination of a lot of things brought on the battle, the last battle, and a few people who were volunteering for the quilt had been involved in the situation when it became unpleasant between us. And as a result of that, I actually had someplace I could go. And
Well, I have to say, you know, I'm going to give total props to Bruce because Bruce was threatened, too, once he started putting you up.
Kudos to the man still today, yes. He actually put up with a lot of abuse on the phone, and I'm not sure about mail, but he was bombarded on a daily basis, the unbelievable numbers of phone calls and so on.
Joan, I had dinner with Judy earlier before we came to the show, and I said, Judy, there's part of the book I have to ask you about, because this thing about Bruce being threatened was during the time that he and I were co-chairs of Pride Week. And right. It involved the crazy ex-lover having threatened to shoot Bruce while he was on stage during Pride. Now, standing beside Bruce would be moi. And I'm like, Judy, don't you think you maybe should have told me that? Because this is a fiction, but mm-hmm. largely autobiographical book, so I had to clarify with her some of the points, and that was one of them that I kind of was made nervous by to find out that was the case, that it actually came down to that. And Joan, not to skip ahead too much, but just to say, the title of the book, The Pieces Form a Heart, comes from the fact that Judy suffers from multiple personality disorder. And this is the first of several books that begins the tale of her finding out about her diagnosis and her coping and how she came to live through all of that.
Right, and that was, you know, amazing too, because Judy actually spent some time in a mental health facility. They could not diagnose her.
No, they didn't.
And, you know, and then Bruce was dealing, of course, unknowingly at that time, as were Jimmy and Matt and several other friends, were also dealing with the personalities. Bruce, in fact, met some of them, you know, again, not knowing what he was dealing with, you know. You know, you would wake up in the night screaming, and he would go in to see what was wrong, and he would talk to somebody that was a four-year-old child, or, you know, and he just didn't know what to think.
No, I didn't know what to think either, to be honest with you. That was one of those, and Bruce would bring it up the next morning at breakfast, or I was having coffee or whatever, and he's like, well, about last night. It's like, what about it? Well, when we did so-and-so, it's like, huh? Yeah, I had no clue. None of us had any clue. None of us knew each other, as they say. And I do have to correct Deborah here just a tad. No. You said that we suffer from multiple personalities. We did, truly. Did we not? Yes, we suffered.
Yeah, you did.
Immeasurably for several years. Now we're surviving with MPD, and that's a very, very important, huge difference in life. And, in fact, we kind of... And I say we, and please accept that and don't argue with me, because that's a real important word in my life. We are set apart from a lot of people who have MPD, or DID as it's called today, in that there's no plan for integration. Just as you don't want to do away with all your neighbors and friends, I don't want to do away with all my neighbors and friends either, because these people take care of me. And I take care of them when it's necessary. And so I will always be a multiple. It's just going to be one of those things.
And how have your friends, you know, Bruce and Jimmy and Matt, how have they come to terms with this? Because as your book progresses, they spend a lot of time talking to each of you.
I know, and I just love them for that. Actually, it's become kind of every day. I mean, there's nothing that sets it apart from any other conversation that they might be having with other friends, I don't believe. If it is a problem for them, I haven't noticed it in 20 years. It was a problem at first, but it's become just kind of blasé. And I accept the fact that I'm not always the one they're talking to. And I, even Jimmy Carper still spends a lot of time with the four-year-old.
And Jimmy's here in the studio with us holding hands, too. One of the things that I asked Judy was, she explained to me that now the different personalities or personages even, they know when afterwards that's who they were and what was going on, whereas before it was like you had gone away.
Oh, it was horrible.
There was no Judy. There might be Judith. There might be Pooh. There might be any number of other person present, but it wasn't Judy. And then when someone talked to Judy, she had no idea.
That's exactly.
And there's only one Judith who knew about everything.
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah. But I think that four-year-old does too, but she doesn't always own it.
But Judith, while is the most knowledgeable one, is not necessarily the most integrated of the personalities. So Judy would not choose to be Judith.
Oh, no. I'm Willie. And even Jimmy would attest to that. He would not want
they'd
to
all say, Jimmy and Bruce and Matt, no, don't let her be Judith.
We all love her, but she definitely is not a day-to-day kind of person who you would want to spend a lot of time with. On that note, I mean, there are so many doing so much all the time. You know, I would get tired if I had to accomplish everything that this body does or sets out to do. It's amazing. And we used to do it on about an hour and a half to 2 hours sleep. And that would upset Bruce, and that would upset our therapist. And, you know, the way everyone learned to cope with it is I just dragged them to therapy with us. That worked.
Those are some good friends that will go into therapy with you.
They are my family, yes.
And talk a little bit about how they became your family, because you had a, you know, very, very difficult, to put it mildly, childhood.
Yeah. Bruce kind of fell into my life by accident. We went to MCCR at the time to have the first Names Project meeting with Brian Kieber, who said, are we interested in bringing the quilt? And everybody said yes. And that was the night I met Bruce. It was like a magnet. He came over to me and started talking, and it's like, who are you and why do I want to talk to you? Because you're like a foot and a half taller than I am and outweigh me by, you know, 100 pounds.
But that being Bruce, that is a foot and a half
taller than
top.
Yes, in any of us. Yeah. Bruce is 6'6". Okay, yeah. I'm 5'6", 5'7". And he was just a very overbearing person. But he wouldn't give up. I mean, every time we went to a Names Project meeting, whether I was there alone or we were there together, then, you know, Bruce always came over and spoke to me and my lover, and she didn't like him. Well, that should have told me something right there.
I don't think she would have liked anyone that was too friendly with you.
Exactly. And then Bruce had his job on the committee, the executive committee, and when his job was done, which was to do the contract with the George R. Brown, he had nothing to do, and I lost my entire volunteer committee. They all went away because it was in May, and they were all studying for finals, and they were all college students. So Bruce and I actually finished out the last 2 weeks by ourselves, always at my house where she could hear us and knew what was going on. But that was kind of interesting. Jimmy was going to be a volunteer, and he ended up getting sick and couldn't volunteer. And I met him later on down the road at KPFT, I believe, right here on After Hours. Not on Queer Voices, but on After Hours. And so it just kind of evolved. Actually, I met Deborah here at KPFT the first time, too. And there are some people you're just drawn to and some people that are drawn to you, and these little magnets stuck, and I was so glad. I still am.
And Joan, let me interject again. Here's something that came up when we were talking. I said, Judy, if I had known what you were going through, I mean, why didn't you call me? Why? I mean, it made me so sad, you know, to think that she just was so alone in some situations. And then later, as I read the book, which you certainly will understand and get right away, was who are the people that Judy is closest to? Gay men. Why is that? Because they are not a threat. Whereas, due to her experience, straight men and women were threatening to her. So even though there may have been this desire for friendship or some kind of closeness, nothing came of it because it wasn't safe.
And it's true. And I told Deborah at dinner that we were very drawn to you when we met you. And that was a real fast, you know, red light that says, okay, go away. Don't get near Deborah. She's trouble.
This is true. No.
Well, we knew she was trouble, and we still do. But it was just the fact that she was a female. There was no way. We've had several in and out of lives in the last several years, and it just doesn't work for us. There's no... in the past, especially, we're talking back in 88, there was no trust there. There was no way to ever let down the guard to trust another woman.
And she's not talking about drawn to me like, oh, I'd like to have her for a girlfriend. She's talking about drawn to as a person to know.
A person to know, a person to get to know, a person to have dinner with once in a while, yeah. And that hadn't changed.
How much do you attribute a lot of that being more willing to you know, let yourself get to know people to the fact that, you know, Jimmy and Bruce and others, you know, worked with you and talked to you and kind of, you know, helped you through this? Because, not to make anything sound simplistic, because it was bad. You wouldn't eat. You know, you'd go to work, you'd come home, and the minute somebody knocked on the door, even somebody that you yourself had invited over, you would run in your room and hide. You know, this was very difficult and traumatic and so many and emotional and, you know, and so many different things that you went through. And I mean, you know, so the fact that these individuals would stick by you as, you know, they're watching this happen, not only stick by you, but, you know, actually get to the point where they're like, we will be here for you. We are not going to let you go. We are not going to let you do this to yourself. I mean, a lot of people would have said, I can't deal with this. I just can't.
I had a lifelong friend who said he couldn't, and I haven't seen him since. I don't know if it was love or pity or what that drew these three particular individuals to me, but I'm very grateful for them. And I think once we got to working on it in therapy a little bit, or actually Jimmy and Bruce both met the four-year-old at home. They didn't meet her in therapy. Then there's this, oh my God, I can't believe this. What in the world is happening? And it may have even been morbid curiosity. I don't know. But they clung tight, and I was, you know, very glad at the time that they did. We all were, as we got to know each other as well as them getting to know us. And the truth is, this running to the bedroom when somebody knock on the door, even if I invited them, I have to share with you, and I have permission to do so, that Judy didn't invite this guy over every night. Sheila did. Judy had no idea who was knocking at the door because she was not a part of that invitation process. Now, you think about that for a minute and think of how difficult it would be for you to open your front door at all hours of the day and night and have somebody that you know just barge in on you like they're coming for the evening. They want coffee, they want pie, they want to sit around and smoke cigarettes, and you have no idea why they're there. You have no reason for their knocking on your door. That nearly drove Judy crazy.
The smoking cigarettes thing is one thing that's interesting, Joan, because in our time of knowing each other, I had some real issues with Judy because sometimes she would smoke, and sometimes she was like the anti-smoker from hell. And as you know, I hate smoke, hate to be around it, am allergic to it. And so there were some things that didn't make sense. Now they make sense to me, but at the time, because some of her people smoke and some of them don't.
Five of us smoked, yes. I was a smoker. What can I say?
Yeah.
But no, Judy was not a smoker, and it was very confusing to her when she would find them in the drawer in the bedroom or a box or something. Had no clue why they were in the car. Yeah.
And was it, or is it Lynn or Judith that is the chain smoker? Didn't you say that?
Judith is definitely a chain smoker. Lynn was pretty close. I would smoke on a rare occasion. But Judy never smoked. Not once in her whole life. She didn't even experiment. But she didn't need to.
But did you inhale?
Yes, always. What's the point? But, you know, and again, on May 13th, I have to brag a little bit here because there are also a number of us who will be celebrating 30 years of clean and sober.
Yay.
Don't want to jinx anything by saying that too soon. But, you know, that's quite an accomplishment, especially when you consider what's sitting here in this chair. But it's been a long
road. The fact that all of you fit in that chair is what's amazing.
Oh, and let me tell you, Joan, I'm no longer 94 pounds. That went by the wayside as well.
But neither are you 300 pounds.
No, neither. No, and we've
but if you put your collective personalities in that chair,
3,000 probably.
Yeah.
Judith herself.
And I asked Judy what was the one question that she really would not want asked? And you want to tell people what that is?
And Joan hasn't asked it. The first question
that
usually...
Did she tell you, Joan, what it was? That she didn't want to be asked?
I don't believe I did. The one question that we do not answer for anyone, even Jimmy, who's sitting here, is how many? How many of you are there? Yes, that seems to be the first question out of almost everybody's mouths. And you know what's funny? Since the book has come out, no one has asked. It's amazing. It's like, maybe they don't want to know. The truth is.
I don't think it's necessarily that important, because the book is really about your journey.
Mm-hmm.
And what you went through and you know, coming to grips with it. And, you know, I think that's the key thing. And the other key thing is to show, you know, how important good friends can be.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, we'll look forward to the next. Do you have a title for the next book?
Not yet. That comes after the books are written, actually.
But you're about halfway through the second book.
Yeah, about three quarters of the way,
and you think there will be four?
Yes, there's plans for four.
And Joan, before I ask the final question, do you want to ask anything else?
Yes, I wanted to ask, how has the book been selling?
You know,
how can people get it?
Okay, that was what I was going to say.
Okay. Well, the easiest, quickest way is actually to go to Amazon.com. I don't know. The larger bookstores are supposed to be carrying it. Honestly, I haven't gone to the bookstores to look for it on the shelves.
Oh, man, I would be there like every day.
Well, honey, you have to remember, I'm walking cripple right now from the car accident. But you can also get it on... Yes.
Do a search on the name
Judy Troop. Judy Troop, and that's the name it's written under. There's... You can also get it from the title, too, The Pieces Form a Heart. A lot of the online bookstores have them now. Target, believe it or not, Walmart, it's amazing. And if you meet me in the streets, because you happen to know me in the Montrose area or in the Houston area,
she's
usually have it in the back of my
book.
Car. You know, that's the first thing they said, you must always have a book with you. It's like, okay.
And we didn't bring one in the studio.
We didn't bring one in the studio. But...
Well, thanks, Joan. We always enjoy having you with us, and we miss you tons.
Yes,
and thank you, Judy Troop, and Judy Reeves, and Judith, and Pooh, and Lynn, and all of you.
Thank you
for being with us tonight on Queer Voices.
Thank you.
We'll explore the ins and outs of folk and roll, lovers and leaders, and skins and shirts. But there are some other musical ups and downs to talk about first.
One love, one heart. Let's get together and feel all right.
Hear the children crying.
One love.
Many queer activists are hailing a decision by leading North American online music retailer iTunes to remove from sale three notoriously homophobic dancehall songs that advocate the brutal killing of gay men. Campaigns protesting concerts by several murder music performers in Europe and North America have resulted in some cancellations. Buju Banton's Boom Bye Bye, Elephant Man's Log On, and T.O.K.'s Chi Chi Man are no longer available at iTunes in Canada or the U.S. In fact, any album they're on has been stricken. Speaking from Toronto with This Way Out correspondent Heather Kitching, Akeem Larcher of Stop Murder Music Canada insists that it's not a question of censorship. His group has targeted other Kill the Queer songs as well, but he says they've made a good start.
I gotta ask, and I don't know if you know the answer to this, but man, when I think of reggae, I think of like Bob Marley and One Love and all that kind of stuff. Like, when the hell did it turn into like, let's shoot queers?
I think there's, I mean, it's sort of, with reggae, definitely, it's very conscious lyrics, you know, very uplifting and talks about social issues and just, you know, sort of bringing together social cohesion. However, dancehall, which has basically sprung out of reggae, it's just different. So it's sort of a genre of music that's come out of reggae, and it's more upbeat, the beat's faster. However, the person's, the artist's, with dancehall, the beats are more aggressive, and sort of the language has been more aggressive. So within the cultural context of Jamaica, where you know, homophobia is present, many of the artists took that opportunity to express that homophobia in their lyrics. Now, they took it way than what any of us really expected, so that violent lyric comes out in the music and social commentary. So in that context, they basically destroyed you know, something that definitely had a huge presence. And I mean, with that said, it's not all the music that's homophobic or anti-gay, just certain songs, quite a number of songs. However, they've definitely tainted dancehall into something that not many people are actually very supportive right now. And I mean, aside from the anti-gay lyrics, in general, a lot of the lyrics have a lot of violent content. So now we're noticing in Jamaica, Red Stripe, the local beer company there, which sponsors many concerts, has actually pulled their sponsorship after a number of years now, and that's like amounting to millions of dollars, because they believe with such violent lyrics, it's not socially positive to support something like that. So that's yet another, you know, call for the issue to be addressed.
Mm-hmm. Have any of these artists recanted?
There's the Reggae Compassionate Act, which is a document calling upon the artists to no longer perform these songs, to produce no more of this sort of content, and then to sort of respect and have a broader view in terms of one love, in terms of human rights, and not discriminating against anyone, particularly the LGBT community. So some artists have actually signed that document, but what we've noticed, it's not basically worth the paper it's signed on.
Mm.
Many persons still return to Jamaica or the Caribbean and continue to perform the very lyrics that we're speaking about. So when they're traveling internationally, they don't do it. They don't sing those songs internationally, but upon return to the Caribbean, where some laws are not present to prosecute persons, or it's just culturally or socially acceptable for something like that to be said, they haven't been challenged. So in terms of that, some of them have basically not produced. I mean, over the last couple of years, we've noticed a positive change in the sense. I think 2006 or 2007 would have been the last song that was really produced, but it doesn't mean that they don't continue singing it whilst on tour. So that's the situation. So I think technically, to me, I don't think any of the artists have actually shown a change of heart. Now that's fairly difficult to get. However, not one of the artists have ever publicly apologized for the mess they've put us in, which is dealing with sort of a homophobic and violent environment in the Caribbean. And Stop Murder Music's aim has been primarily to provide support to persons who are under assault in these islands, and the music has definitely played a part. But none of them have actually apologized or tried to change that situation, and to me, they're always going to be on the radar for us to remove the content and, you know, let's try to get things right.
Mm-hmm.
And I think iTunes at the moment is, they've surpassed Walmart at the moment in terms of being the largest music supplier. So it sends a clear message to the artists and to the community that this sort of content shouldn't be allowed. And if it was any other issue, whether it be race or religion, someone actually advocating for the death of anyone, you know, it wouldn't be there. So the same ball should apply to sexual orientation, most definitely.
Mm-hmm. There are a lot of leading activists who believe that freedom of speech should be preserved, you know, regardless of the circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, for so long, various anti-free speech laws were used to prosecute queers. I mean, Little Sisters Bookstore here in Vancouver has fought for, you know, over two decades with Canada Customs over them seizing things that are allegedly harmful. Pink Triangle Press, which publishes Extra West, fought censorship for years and years and years in their early days. So there's a lot of sensitivity in the queer community about censorship, even when it comes to censoring people who are talking about killing us. You push it underground. You know, you don't eliminate demand for this stuff. You push it underground, and then it becomes harder to monitor what people are actually saying about you.
The right to free speech is not absolute. It stops up to a certain point. Having us included as a grounds for non-discrimination sexual orientation as a group, also we need to be able to look at that law and actually use it in terms of persons that are advocating and basically calling for our death. This is, you know, not be tolerated if it was targeted towards blacks or Jews. So as a community, I think we need to be definitely robust enough to be able to say, although we've experienced experience many issues of censorship around our sexuality, around our issues, you know, in the past, we have to be able to use those tools right now. If we're willing and we're going to allow persons to sing to the depth of us because of our sexual orientation and allow it to continue, then, you know, I don't see how or why that should be possible and how censorship doesn't come into play there. It's not about censorship. It's about the law, and the law says this.
It is censorship.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the law isn't. It's censoring someone who's calling for their death. You know, calling someone to pour acid on someone else. And when we look at the communities where this can actually have an impact, it's important that such artists are not given a platform to sort of continue this sort of hatred.
That was Akeem Larcher of Stop Murder Music Canada talking with correspondent Heather Kitching. He says his group will be submitting a list of other murder music that they want removed from iTunes, presumably including hate-filled anti-gay songs by such performers as Beanie Man, Capleton, SZA, and Vibes Cartel. Activists are pressuring other online music retailers, including Amazon.com, to follow suit.
Hello, I'm CJ Cox, director of Latter Days and Kiss the Bride, and you're listening to This Way Out Radio Magazine.
A beloved duo, a touring Californian, and a relative newcomer are the entertaining artists in this month's audiophile.
This house is built of oak and stone. Here I make my stand. If you want to know me, you'll have to take me as I am.
The seventh album by the duo Wishing Cher is called Folk and Roll. Hi, I'm J.D. Doyle.
I'm Chris Wilson, and you're listening to Audiophile. The album features both new songs and several of their classics.
Standing in these new plowed fields, mud up to my knees. Everybody's got their words to say, but I do just as I please.
Wishing Chair is comprised of Miriam Davidson and Kaya Hartwood. Miriam says they took a different approach to making this album.
Folk and Roll is Kaya and I recording right in front of the mics, no overdubs, straight through the songs like we do on our live show, and we're trying to find a balance between our folk selves and our rock and roll sides, and I think we really hit it this time.
Trees that they're cutting, high, higher ground, the tops of the mountains, a higher ground. They poison the waters, high, higher ground. Better move them all to higher ground. Better move them all to higher ground. Better move them all to higher ground.
Find out more about the album, Folk and Roll, at www.wishingchair.com.
Southern California artist Sasha Sackett has just released his third album called Lovers and Leaders.
Your halo's on my mind, wearing through thoughts of fire. Can you read? Am I right? For you, your halo's all I find. Wonder why you shine so bright when I've been reading.
Sasha's music is classically influenced and piano driven, full of self-examination and intimacy that draws you in.
Lovers and Leaders was basically an album that came out of me trying to be a lover and trying to be a leader. I was trying to hold a relationship and be a touring artist at the same time, and it seemed like it was just something that was impossible to do. So the album basically came out of me trying to see if I could do both at the same time.
Yeah.
about Sasha Sackett's album Lovers and Leaders at www.sashasackett.com. That's www.sashasackett.com.
All my life, I wanna be the leading man sometime. It's not that I am uncommitted, I work hard to get it right, but not enough it seems to win this fight. Still I go on and on, believing in myself, cause I am strong, so strong. But it's always someone else. When is it my turn?
And gay marriage is just one of the areas covered in Skins and Shirts, the second album by Stephen Franz.
Skins and Shirts is my second independent release, and it features 9 songs dealing with the black, white, and of course gray aspects of life and love. It was produced by award-winning singer-songwriter Hans York, who pulled together an A-list of studio musicians and really took the songs to a new level. So, really excited about the results, and hope your listeners out there are too. Enjoy.
Find out more about the CD, Skins and Shirts, by Stephen Franz at www.stephenfranz.com. That's www.stephenfranz.com.
That's it for this edition of Audiophile. You can write to us at our new address, 594 Sawdust Road, number 273, Spring, Texas, 77380. Or by visiting our website at www.audiophile.org. That's www.audiophile.org.
Audiophile is produced by Chris Wilson, J.D. Doyle, and Christopher David Trentum. I'm Chris Wilson.
And I'm J.D. Doyle. Keep listening.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international gay and lesbian radio magazine. This week, John Beaupre, Donna Ann Ward, Rex Walker with Bill Kelly, Heather Kitching, Steve Pride, and Chris Wilson, J.D. Doyle, and Christopher David Trentum contributed program material. Bob Marley and the Wailers, Wishing Chair, Sasha Sackett, and Stephen Franz performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Listen online to This Way Out exclusively at outinamerica.com. You can also click on the Listen Now banner at the top of our website, thiswayout.org. This Way Out operating expenses are underwritten by a grant from the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation and through direct charitable donations from our listeners. Thank you. Please log on to thiswayout.org to see how you can help keep this program on the air. Email us at tworadio@aol.com. or write to P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on WPKN Bridgeport, Connecticut, KAZU Pacific Grove, California, 3PVR Mill Park, Victoria, and more than 175 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
This Way Out is heard every week as part of Queer Voices. You are listening to 90.1 FM KPFT.
Can I turn to? You give me something I can hold on to. I know you think I'm like the others before. We saw your name and number on the wall. Jimmy, I got your number. I need to make you mine. Jimmy, don't change your number. It's 675309. It's 675309. It's 675309. It's 675309. Jimmy, you're the boy for me. You don't know me, but you make me so happy. I tried to call you before, but I lost my nerve. I tried my imagination, but I was disturbed.
Point 1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. Now, more of Queer Voices with Jack Belinsky and the entire Queer Voices crew. Well, if that song sounded a little bit familiar, 8675309, that was an old, what did you say it was, Tommy Two-Tone?
Tommy Two-Tone, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That was actually Mark Weigel doing the cover of that. And both of the songs that we played this evening by Mark Weigel are from his 2003 CD, Different and the Same.
Good times. I love that, you know, the remake of the old songs.
Yeah. You have an announcement.
Yes. This Friday, last week we had a group interviewed on our air, on our program, Wishing Chair. They're having a house concert at 7:30 p.m. Friday, May 2nd, in Northwest Houston. Please visit their website, wishingchair.com, for further information.
And I want to talk about a little bit about the Transgender Unity Dinner that was on Saturday. Very nice event. I think they had about 250 people there. Really, I think that was a record crowd. And, of course, Kindred Spirits had their celebration also, the reunion. And I imagine that was very much a success. So a lot of things are happening.
Yes, very active this time of the year. Hmm.
And next week on Queer Voices, David Elliott will be joining us from Washington, D.C. for his Inside the Beltway and Beyond report, which is a slightly irreverent look at politics from a gay perspective. In celebration of Cinco de Mayo, some queer Mexican music and news of activities and events in the Houston Hispanic GLBT community, the National Leather Association, NLA, Houston chapter, will be here to discuss the leather lifestyle. It's not just for queers, you know. And the Vagina Monologues, with a twist. We'll talk with Joe Watts about his production celebrating the 10th anniversary of Eve Ensley's groundbreaking work. And, of course, news wrap and features from This Way Out. And that's next week on Queer Voices, but stay tuned now for J.D. Doyle's Queer Music Heritage.
You bought the sofa.
That song was Crocodile Tears by a late 1970s act called The Mumps, and it's just one of the acts featured on this month's show that have a common thread. This is J.D. Doyle, and you're listening to Queer Music Heritage, a part of Queer Voices every month on KPFT. The common thread of all the music on this show is singer-songwriter Christian Hoffman, and I've got an extensive interview with him, and we'll explore his involvement with The Mumps, German opera singer Klaus Nomi, and Christian's own very full career. But first, I want to give some quick background information on the lead singer of The Mumps, Lance Loud. In 1973, on the PBS network, there was a 12-part documentary called An American Family that caused quite a controversy. It attracted 10 million viewers and, in a way, was the first reality series. The show chronicled the lives of the Loud family from Santa Barbara, California, which included Pat and Bill Loud's marriage becoming a divorce and one of their sons, Lance, being very out of the closet. Being Lance's best friend, Christian Hoffman was included in the TV series, and a few years later, they moved to New York City and formed the pop-punk group The Mumps. Christian wrote almost all of the band's music. Over the years, Lance became a rock music columnist, and also toward the end of his life, had a column in The Advocate, which I remember quite well. His death from AIDS in 2001, at age 50, was chronicled in a follow-up PBS documentary, A Death in an American Family. Okay, now you know the players, and I'm very pleased to share with you my interview with Christian Hoffman. Tell me how you got started with The Mumps.
Well, that's pretty easy. I went to high school with Lance Loud, and so we were best friends in high school, and we were in the same art class with our art teacher who inspired us, Mr. Baker, and then we were really excited about music. We're into the Kinks and the Velvet Underground and all these other records that were actually fairly obscure at the time they came out, and only came into sort of like prominence later on with a high critical regard. And so we were obsessed with music, and then I was going to go to art school, and went to art school for about 2 months, and I hated it, so Lance said, let's just move to New York, and we moved to New York and saw the New York Dolls, and then we just decided, well, we can do that. We actually did have a high school band, but it was kind of a joke band that we did with Lance and his brothers. So we were always into playing and making fools of ourselves, but it was really the New York Dolls that completely inspired us to just go ahead and make a real band and write all our own songs and get out there and do it.
How was the name of the band picked?
The name of the band was picked in a ridiculous way. We just made a list of names, and it's funny because lots of the names went on to be names of relatively famous bands. And I don't know why we decided to use The Mumps. It just sounded funny, I guess. You know, it's been sort of like a millstone and an albatross and also an inspiration. We wanted something that was catchy and short.
It's kind of a romantic tale to say you ran away to New York where you and Lance formed The Mumps and quickly became darlings of the club scene. How does that description jive with what happened?
Well, it doesn't jive at all with what really happened. I mean, in one sense it does, but in another sense, no matter what we did, as much as we thought we were making the most exciting, I wouldn't say it was commercial, but we considered the music we were making essential. Like, it was fast and loud, yet it was highly crafted and literate and funny and clever, and like all of the bands we'd followed, from the Kinks to the Sparks to the Stooges to the Beatles to through everyone, we thought we were in that tradition. And then when we finally decided to play out, we opened for Cherry Vanilla at Trudy Heller's. That was our first gig ever. And David Bowie was actually in the audience because Lance knew David Bowie's drug dealer. But that didn't really lead to anything because it was an audience that was more attuned to the Manhattan Transfer. And it was only when we found our way to CBGB's. We got a following pretty quickly, but punk didn't gel as a movement right away. And also, when it did gel, we weren't considered as essential as one might think, even though we were founders of it. I mean, there really were legitimately, there was the Mumps, Blondie, the Ramones, and Television basically were the bands that were playing CBGBs. And so we did sort of invent that scene, but it soon became hardened into factions, and we were kind of like a little too pop to be hip or something. At first, it wasn't really very friendly that way.
In the liner notes for this next song from the first Mumps CD, Lance Loud wrote that before Safe Sex, there was Christian Hoffman. Tell me about the song, I Like to Be Clean.
It is weird because it is sort of about that. I was very neurotic about sexuality, and there was a whole bunch of things. Like, I felt like even though we were gay, and even though it was sort of, like, Lance was out as gay, but he had never said he was gay, and here we were in this highly competitive scene with a whole bunch of straight people, so I just said, you know, if someone asks you if you're gay, just lie about it, you know, and I was kind of saying it jokingly, but it was also like it would be a good career move, and it would keep the mystery going, and then it was the beginning of the spread of herpes, and yet there was all this kind of swinging and indiscriminate sex going on. So I used that as a springboard to get to, basically, it's about a fear of intimacy.
But wasn't it well known that Lance was gay by that time?
It was well known And yet, that like the whole thing about him having come out on the series, he never did come out on the series. And he actually didn't come out till quite some time afterwards. I think it was on one of the talk shows. It might have been on Dick Cavett or something. But he said, like, that notion was forced upon me. And I really agreed with him, even though we were both openly gay to all of our friends, even from the age of 16 in high school. In the real world, you know, we weren't dressing gay to ourselves. We were dressing like rock stars. We always identified with David Bowie and Mick Jagger, and it wasn't a gay thing at all. And we didn't feel gay in our pursuit of life or art or experience or sensory delight or anything. The message of gay at the time we were coming out was boring and clony, and it was kind of constricting. And we wanted to be free to be whatever technicolor people we could. So it's sort of like we didn't want to be defined by this one thing. And it did also feel like it was homophobic in the punk scene, and it was homophobic in the world, and we felt like we wouldn't be able to have a career if we said we were gay. But Lance was more comfortable with it than I was. I guess I was more ambitious than him. I really thought we were going to be Lennon and McCartney. I was a moron, but I did believe that.
Okay, all that started out as an introduction to the song I Like to Be Clean from 1977.
Elbows brush, secrets couple in the darkness. Cheeks will blush, semicircles in the dark, nestling close.
That was a little of I Like to Be Clean, and unfortunately on this show, with so much ground to cover, I won't be able to play complete versions of the song, but you'll get ample taste of the music along the way. What was your role in the band?
My role was the role of an adult. I was the default adult in the band. Lance got to be crazy and inspired and dance around and talk about the vision and take drugs and be drunk, and everybody else got to work on their various crafts, but I actually sort of had, I chose this, but I had to write all the songs and I had to show up and be on time and figure everything out. And the guys were all great, especially once we got to our optimal lineup, which was with Paul Ruttner, Rob Dupre, Kevin Kiley, and Lance. Although our later bass player, Joe Katz, was fantastic as well. But I actually, at that point, I wrote most of the bass parts. I wrote some of the guitar parts. I wrote, you know, 99.5% of the songs. I set up rehearsals. I helped organize stuff. Was sort of the default person who had to make the big decisions. And I was also the one who could translate Lance's vision to everybody else, because he was so crazy that they didn't speak his language. But since I'd been with him since high school, I knew what he meant by everything.
From this perspective of time, how do you think the gayness of the band played into its success?
Oh, I think it completely prevented us from being successful. I think that time and time again, opportunities came up, and I think that if there were a decision to be made in our favor, and there was somebody else that they could favor at that moment, they would favor the straight people. There's a point in cases, the Dickies, our managers who were managing us first also managed the Dickies, and the A&M was going to sign one punk band, and they put us and the Dickies up, and they went with the Dickies. Now, I could be completely imagining this, but we had been around longer than the Dickies. We were more established on both coasts than the Dickies. I think they wrote fantastic songs, and I think they put out, you know, great records, so this isn't anything against them. But I definitely think one of the reasons we weren't signed was because we were the band with the bag. And I do think that I think we were marginalized by that, whether it was spoken or unspoken. I really believe it damaged us. I don't believe it was an open market, and I don't believe people were without prejudice. Oh, I have one more thing to say about that while I blabber on. It's like the other way to look at it is like, you know, you can say Jane County established him herself as a gay artist, but that was the hook. And we weren't aiming to be a gay novelty act. We wanted to write songs that would be compared to all the great masters of pop rock. So that was our ambition. We didn't want to be ghettoized by a gay novelty quirk. And I adore Jane County, but I think, you know, there's a difference.
What do you think is the place in history of the Muffs?
I think our real place in history is one of the, I would say, first off, we are one of the founders of the New York punk rock movement. You know, I use the term punk rock loosely because that was a media term. We didn't feel like that when we were doing it. We felt like we were East Village bands that had a certain sensibility, liking short, loud, contrarian songs. But I do think that we were that. You know, we were one of the founders. I also think, you know, not to toot my own horn, but we had the best songs out of that whole movement. I mean, when Clem Burke came and jammed with us, he said, you know, you write better songs than Blondie, but I gotta go with the band with the girl in it. So I think our legacy is to be the founders, one of the most important founders of the East Village punk rock New York 70s scene, which we've never been credited for. And then after that, as being a vehicle for Lance Loud's crazy, you know, gyrations and incredible gifts as a lead singer. And so we were an early band with an out lead singer. And then hopefully as a showcase for my songwriting. Someone else was supposed to say that. I'm not, but.
Is there a Muffs song of which you're particularly proud?
Oh, I love them all. One of the most embarrassing things about me is that I've tried to go back and look at my songs and go like, I wish I hadn't written that, or God, that's embarrassing. And there are a few, but I'm happy with all those songs. The Awkward Age, I think, is a fantastic song. You know, I'm happy with that song. I'm happy with how succinct it is. I think the melody's great. I've said this before in interviews, but Alan Betrock, who was a really great rock historian, said, you must have stolen that from the Idle Race. And I thought, like, God, that is the biggest compliment in the world.
Inadequate minds, inadequate means, inadequate little go between. What? You grumble and grow. What? What cling to the hope? And so you keep building, 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 building. The toothpicks and the
found when studying Christian's career that there were always overlaps. He didn't just stop doing one thing and start another. While still in the Mumps, among other projects, he was writing songs for Klaus Nobe. So let's take a side journey to that world, and From Another World is probably a good description for Klaus. I adapted this short bio from Wikipedia. Klaus Nobe was a German countertenor noted for remarkable vocal performances and an unusual, otherworldly, elfin stage persona. Nomi is remembered for bizarrely theatrical live performances, heavy makeup, unusual costumes, and a highly stylized signature hairdo. His songs were equally unusual, ranging from interpretations of classic opera to outrageous covers of 1960s pop standards. Here's a bit of him doing the aria Mon cœur s'ouvre à ta voix, or My Heart Opens to Your Voice, from Saint-Saëns' opera Samson and Delilah. One highlight of his career was when he and Joey Arias backed up David Bowie in 1979 for Bowie's appearance on Saturday Night Live. In that era, Klaus was perhaps too avant-garde to become mainstream, and any hopes of that ended with his death from AIDS in August of 1983, one of the first celebrities to die from that illness. His career has been documented in a fascinating film from 2004 called The Know Me Song, which I highly recommend. Christian Hoffman appears prominently in the documentary. I want to switch gears. How did you first meet Klaus Nomi?
I met Klaus Nomi at... Oh, God, I've told this story so many times. But I met Klaus Nomi. There was this thing called the New Wave Vaudeville Show. It first started with the Monster Movie Club that Ann Magnuson ran, Club 57, which was the club in the basement of a little church at 57 St. Mark's Place. And in it, they had Susan Hennepert and Tom Scully started the Monster Movie Club. And then they decided to put on a show called New Wave Vaudeville because they thought one thing about the New Wave was that a lot of the bands and the acts were horrible, but you can stand 3 minutes of anything. They put out a big ad all over the East Village that said, "We want Nazi slaves and freaks." And... a whole bunch of people answered the call, and I personally was already friends with them, so I was going to be in it anyway. But they got, like, you know, a singing dog, and a bunch of bands did crazy things. Lance got up and sang ASPCA to the tune of the Village People singing YMCA. But they also got Klaus, and Ann Magnuson, who I've worked with for, you know, 30 years since, was directing it. He auditioned for her standing on a snowbank and just sang some a cappella opera, and so he came out there and sang the aria from Samson and Delilah in the New Wave Vaudeville show, and the audience was just flabbergasted and dumbfounded and didn't know what to think because he was so totally realized. There wasn't anything unformed about him. His voice was totally incredible, and everybody thought that he was lip-syncing to some old 78. They just couldn't believe he was really singing that way. And after that, Anya Phillips, who was managing the Contortions at the time, which I was in, she just called me up the next day and said, "You should make a band for that Klaus Nomi." And so I just called him up and said, "Can I make a band for you?" And he said, "Okay." And that's just how fast everything worked then. You just would run into someone on the street, and it would just turn into some fantastic adventure.
So that's how you started writing songs for him?
Yeah, the very first thing I did was say, "You need to sing Lightning Strikes, because you've got this operatic range, and so why not put it to service in reinterpreting a pop song that will really exploit your range?" And so that was, and then I thought, well, we've got to have some original material. So then I started writing songs for him, and he had already got all of his friends, like Joey Arias and the other dancers together, Tony Frares. They all had gotten the visual thing together and the way they were going to dance and his look, that three-pronged trident haircut, and all of that stuff was already together. But I sort of was the author of the original pop musical vision for Klaus. He, of course, knew everything about opera and I knew nothing, so all the classical pieces were his choice and his arrangement.
Well, he recorded several of your songs, like A Simple Man, After the Fall, The Know Me Song. Perhaps the best known is Total Eclipse. Could you talk about that one?
First, I wrote the Know Me Song, which was sort of like an easy joke on his name, Do You Know Me Now? But I also wanted... I really thought Klaus was so fully formed that he needed just to announce himself and what his intentions were in a pop format. And I just kind of threw that one out like, "You're going to be shocked when you see me." But then I thought, you know, that doesn't really say anything about who he is or what message he's delivering. You really did have the sense that the whole world could end at any moment. And so he was very much an advocate of, since the future is so unstable, we need to be as artistically crazy and out there and fulfilled as we possibly can at every moment of our life, because there might not be another one. And so I tried to say that in Total Eclipse. I tried to really make it a statement of intent for him.
Low cost, low cost.
kind of a natural follow-up lyrically would be After the Fall. And he comes
That was actually intended as a sequel. It was sort of like, here's Total Eclipse. You know, in retrospect, it seemed kind of cheerless. And so I wanted to say After the Fall. In a weird way, it was kind of my John Lennon song. I was saying love will win no matter what happens, you know. No matter what happens, we'll be together and we can build something. But I did think of him, I thought, like, you can't be too portentous or pretentious or anthemic for Klaus, you know. It's like his voice, however heavy the message is that might weigh a lesser talent down, his voice will make it soar. So I did think... I say to use Bowie as a cue, but he really was. I thought, like, we can be as big in concept as Ziggy and get away with it, because here's a personality and a concept that's so huge that it will envelop it and it will lift it. So, you know, the everything I say about these songs may sound incredibly pretentious, but I felt free to be pretentious because I knew that he could salvage it and make it
fly. He could pull it off.
Yeah.
Oh, I told you about the total eclipse now. I feel it caught you unaware, but I'm telling you, hold on, hold on. Tomorrow will be there. And even though you went to church upon Sunday, you thought you didn't even have a prayer. I'm telling you, hold on, hold on. Tomorrow will be there. After the fall will be more than you. After it all knows the way. After the fall.
From the documentary, I got the feeling that as he became more successful, he kind of turned his back on his friends, or was that more the work of the record companies?
It was a variety of things. First of all, Klaus really, really wanted to be successful, and he really wanted to be a big rock star. He didn't even want to be a big rock star. He wanted to be a big sensation. He wanted to be like a cross between Marlon Brando and Frank Sinatra or something, you know, but on his own terms as an outer space alien who sang in falsetto. But he believed in himself that this is what was going to happen, and the record company told him that's what's going to happen. They said, we're going to make you the star you always dreamed of being. And then the record company would press him and say, but you can't get there with these people. And so he did leave us in his wake, and his management and record company were not only manipulative, but they were downright liars and crooks. And they were horrible to Klaus, too. They weren't just horrible to us. You know, they literally worked him to death. When they saw that he was falling ill, although they didn't know what it was at the time, they said, you better keep touring, because they were afraid he might be too sick to make it to the next tour. So they wanted to milk every last dime out of him. So they were equal opportunity horrible people.
Well, watching you in the film, I could see a very natural bitterness in your comments. You didn't smile very much in that documentary. And, you know, it's understandable. Record companies took your publishing rights, and it's pretty hard to fight a label like RCA in a foreign country.
Yeah, that's true. I do feel like, as in any documentary, you can't tell all the stories. And this is the story of Klaus. And I was reduced to a storytelling device. So there was hours of footage of me describing the joys of working with Klaus, the joys of how exciting it was when it first started to happen, what good friends I was with the bands I was in, how much fun I had writing songs for him, how he came to Lance's birthday party and baked a cake, you know, all that kind of stuff. None of that made it into the movie. So when I first saw the movie, I actually started crying, because I thought I'd been reduced to this person who whines about money. And I felt like, is that who I really am? It took me maybe 6 months to get over it. You know, and then I realized, like, Andy Horn, the director, had to tell Klaus's story, and I was useful as a device to tell that one aspect of the story, either because I was more articulate or because what happened to me was more extreme.
As I already mentioned, Klaus Nomi was known for both his operatic arias and his outrageous cover versions of songs from the 60s or earlier. I couldn't resist putting together a quick medley of some of those songs.
to understand. You're old enough to learn the makings of a man. Listen to me, baby, it's time to settle down. Am I asking too much for you to stick around? Every boy wants a girl he can trust to the very end. Baby, that's you, won't you stay? But till then, when I see your lips begging to be kissed, I can't stop.
Yes, don't say I can't play with other boys. You just heard my medley of the songs Lightning Strikes, Just One Look, Falling in Love Again, I Feel Love, Ding Dong the Witch is Dead, and of course, Leslie Gore's You Don't Own Me. I'm going to take a quick break to invite you to check out my website. If you visit it while you're listening, you can see the playlist and follow along while looking at photos of the artists and recordings. I've always considered our music history as a visual as well as an audio experience. Again, that's at queermusicheritage.com. Also, for more very queer programming, please listen to After Hours with Jimmy Carper every Friday night, Saturday morning from 1 to 4 a.m. on KPFT. It's queer radio with attitude. As I said earlier, the music career of Christian Hoffman has always overlapped many areas at the same time. In 1981, as Klaus Nomi was releasing his first albums in Europe, Christian had a band called the Swinging Madisons. Can you tell us about that band?
The Swinging Madisons, it's sort of hard to describe what that period was like, because everyone was doing 30 different things. So at the same time as I was doing the Swinging Madisons, I was still in the Mumps, who were about to break up. I was already doing a band with Klaus. I was also doing a folk band with Ann Magnuson called Bleecker Street Incident. So my idea of the Swinging Madisons was to do a song where I could sing Volare. That was about as far as it went. I loved Bobby Rydell's version of Volare, and then I thought, like, I should just start a joke band where I get to be the lead singer, because I never get to be the lead singer. And then we did that, and then I wrote a bunch of very silly songs, and that was another weird thing. It was a band that just started as a joke, and I had a couple members of the Mumps in it, and I made them all wear turbans the first time we played, and I just lay on the floor and screamed. And that band became very successful very fast and got a record contract after we were together less than 3 months. Whereas the Mumps, you know, worked for almost 7 years and never had a record contract. So it was just a bizarre one of those things. I wanted a band that was just fun. I'd been in bands that were too angst-filled for too long, and I thought, like, we can get together and have a few laughs and dance around, and I can do a kind of cross between rockabilly, Bobby Rydell, and a little bit of soul. Although, if you've heard my music, you know I have no soul.
Well, you released a 5-song EP, and
yes.
What's your favorite track from that?
Mediocre Dream, which I'm actually redoing for my new album. I think it was a really good, solid tip of the hat to Nuggets type 60s garage psychedelia, but it also, I still think the lyrics are pretty funny. I mean, it just, I was watching TV late one night and somebody was talking about their dreams, and I thought, like, God, your dreams are so mediocre. And then I thought, like, America's dream is mediocre. It's like, can't they aspire to anything better? And so I thought that was a funny title, and I still think it's pretty funny.
All it takes of education to see how the game is played, but it don't get in my mediocre dream. And it takes some inspiration to see how the paint is sprayed, but it don't get in my mediocre dream.
I encourage you to visit Christian's website, logically found at www.christianhoffman.com. It's very interesting and covers a lot of ground, just like his career has for the last, 30 years. There's a long list on this site of artists that he's performed with, written with, and played on their albums, like Lydia Lunch, Elvez, Dave Davies of the Kinks, Abby Davis, and Ann Magnuson. The list is quite long, and if I added a couple hours to this show, I couldn't do it justice. Instead, I'm going on to 1993, when Christian released his first solo album called I Don't Love My Guru Anymore.
I saw a special depth of soul in her eyes, and she looked through me and she just passed me by. Yeah, oh no, I don't love my guru anymore.
So all that kind of got you ready for your solo album.
My first solo album, actually, it got me ready for that. I love folk music, and I was in love with folk music, and I was also in love with the Left Bank, and, you know, the idea of doing an album with lots and lots of strings and everything at a time when nobody was interested in that, and it sounded like you would be shot if you did it. You know, now everybody's doing it, but back then it was like there was Pearl Jam and Nirvana, and I decided to do an acoustic album that sounded like the Left Bank. But what really happened was that the Swinging Madisons had broken up, Bleecker Street Incident had broken up, Mumps was long gone, Klaus was dead. I was here in L.A. I'd only moved here to be with the Swinging Madisons, and then I was here, even though I didn't like this town, I just sort of was living here and didn't know how to get out. And I thought, okay, I'm going to quit music. It's too painful, and all my experiences in it have led to nothing. No matter how big you got, nothing good ever happens. And then I realized, even when I quit music, I just kept writing songs, and I kept writing these acoustic folk songs. And so it was actually a very low ebb in my musical career, where I was struggling with ever being involved in music again. And then my manager came back into the picture, and he said, these are the best songs you've ever written. I can get these released if you just record an album. So I recorded an album of those songs that I was never going to record because they were all too sad and straightforward. I thought, you know, they were kind of naked. I wasn't guarding myself the way I did in every other project by making it silly or ironic. And that ended up being my first album. And that sort of started me on my way to whatever I ended up being.
Again, I'm going to have to gloss over Christian's work with other artists to bring us up to 2002 and an album I found irresistible. Imagine Christian singing duets with Rufus Wainwright, Elvez, Paul Rubens, otherwise known as Pee Wee Herman, Lydia Lunch, Van Dyke Parks, and many other of his co-conspirators from over the years. Many of these folks you may not have heard of, but you should have. The album is called And, and that's displayed by the ampersand symbol on the CD cover. What inspired that album?
What inspired that album was a record that never happened. I was standing, I think I was watching Turbo Negro at Spaceland, and Belinda Carlisle, who, as you know, was sort of a friend of mine. We're not close friends, but especially because she lives in France. But we remained in vague touch over the years. And she used to just love it when the Swinging Madisons played Having My Baby. It was her favorite song. So I said, let's do a single. Let's do a duet doing Having My Baby. And she said, sure. So I recorded the backing track for Having My Baby. And she got laryngitis. And she couldn't come to the session. And then she moved back to France. And I never saw her again. So that never happened. And then my record company said, well, why don't you just do a whole album of duets? So it was kind of like a byproduct of a silly thing that never occurred, and it wasn't my idea at all. And I was kind of resenting it because I had all these songs ready for my third album, and then I was forced into this kind of concept of duets. But as it came to start recording them, I realized it was really a gift, and then I threw out a lot of the songs and wrote new songs with people in mind.
How did you pick the artists to participate on the album?
I just picked my favorite people and hoped that they would show up. I mean, Russell Mayall, even though I had a slight relationship with him, because he was managed by the same people as me 15 years before that album came out, I thought, like, well, I have his home address. But I never really expected him to show up. So it all just happened because Russell was super nice and decided to do this project, and he did it because I said, well, why are you doing this? And he said, because it's a great song. So he not only did it, but he did it with positive feedback and goodwill, and it was really fun. And then everybody else were just people that I knew and admired. In fact, there were more people that said yes, but they couldn't get on the album.
Christian mentioned Russell Mayall of Sparks, and their duet was Devil in My Care. Check out the Ronettes-inspired intro to the song.
Devil may care.
What is your most lyrically gay song?
Gay? Lyrically gay? Let me see. Boy, that's a hard one. You better name some names. I would have to look through the whole catalog.
Well, I wonder if a candidate would be I Could Die for Cute.
Yes, I that's a good one, because that definitely is like, I'm admitting my age, I'm looking at the young guy, he's across the room, and I'm thinking, well, I have no hope, and yet I'm going to take the plunge and approach him anyway. So that definitely is an out gay song. And that is funny, because when Steve McDonald agreed to sing on that, I specifically picked the lines that wouldn't embarrass so much. Like, he didn't have to sing Your Little Goatee or any of those things. You know, he just got to sing I Don't Want to Be Free. So that is a very gay song. It's very openly gay.
I could act all cute. Oh, I perceive your mouth, trap mind in the diminutive. Oh, you little brute, so casually you dismiss the love I have to give.
I don't want to be free. Bargain for me. Parenthetically, I could die for cute.
Helping Christian out on the song I Could Die for Cute was Steve McDonald of the act Red Cross. What's next for you?
Well, just my new album, and it's weird because on And, I got so used to writing with other people that now I'm going back and doing something with my voice on every song, and I'm going like, is this tiresome? Especially because, as I've told you before, I don't like my voice. But I feel like it's a really strong set of songs. I tried to edit it down to a manageable part, but my backer said, you should just do all the songs. So it's going to be 17 or 18 songs long. I'm just not going to hold back, and I'm doing what I hope will be the most pretentious thing I've ever done. So I'm just in the middle of doing that now, and I'm pretty excited about it.
What's the name of the new album?
The new album is called Bop. And I just wanted to call it something that was, first of all, true to my position as a gay elder, and also true to my position as someone who likes to be fancy. And also, you can put the letters really big on a CD, because CD packaging is unfortunately not as exciting as album packaging used to be. So if you want to make something pretty, it has to be very simple.
You're sharing with me a little bit of one of the songs. Tell me about Evil.
Well, Evil is a direct response to the Republican regime. And so Evil I wrote specifically in response to George Bush Jr. and all the horrible things that done by his regime, where I actually think never before in the history of the world were we able to bring about the actual physical end of the world without the aid of atomic or nuclear bombs. But now that we are capable of doing it, he's doing it. So Evil was kind of like about that, and it was a very specific admission, like, I didn't believe in evil before, and now I do.
And that's all I'm allowed to play, as that's an exclusive, a pre-release sampling of the song Evil from Christian's next album, Fop. I'm down to the last song, but before I get to it, I want to thank you all for listening, and I want to especially thank Christian Hoffman for the fascinating interview. His website is at www.christianhoffman.com, and Christian is spelled with a K. The site is definitely worth an extended visit. And for more info on this show, you may want to also check out my site, www.queermusicheritage.com. And as always, if you have questions or comments about any of the music I featured, please write me at qmheritage@aol.com. This is J.D. Doyle for Queer Voices on KPFT in Houston. If you are to be remembered for the writing and recording of one single song, what would it be?
I need to be remembered for my entire catalog, baby.
Pick one.
That's a very mean-spirited question, and I hate you. But, I'm Scarecrow, I guess. I mean, I love Scarecrow, and sometimes I think that it's tired and it's too specific, since it's about Matthew Shepard and all that stuff, but... like the occasions when I've been sort of encouraged to revisit it, because it's just been used for a movie called True Loved, and so because they wanted to license it, I actually had to listen to it and think if I can still stand that song. And I actually think it's pretty successful on its own terms, you know. But I have a healthy ego, and I think a lot of my songs are successful on their own terms. I'm just waiting for the rest of the world to figure that out.
Tell me about the work you've done with Rufus.
Well, the work I've done with Rufus is always a total surprise. I was his keyboard player, which is shocking to say because he's a much better keyboard player than I am, and I played the harpsichord parts and the string parts and the little extra parts, but I was a keyboard player for about a year and a half, and I toured with him, and I got to sing backup vocals with him, and... you know, I don't know if my voice really melded with him, but every time I sang with him, I felt like I was resonating in some Tibetan bell. It just was something that you could hear when the resonances matched. And so it was really a wonderful, a wonderful gift. And also because I adored so much. The reason I met Rufus was because I wanted to meet his mom, Kate McGarrigle, who I think is one of the greatest songwriters of all time. And then, by mistake, it turned out that Rufus was a great songwriter too. So I had a really happy time touring with him, but then it was over, and we were the first band he was ever in, and he was like 24 at the time, and he wanted to try out other musicians, and I just assumed, like, well, that makes sense. You know, if I were young, I'd want to try out a new flavor too. And I just thought I'd never see him again. You know, I just thought he's moving on to that world of rock stardom. He's got a big record label. I have nothing. You know, I have a relative critical regard, but I'm very outsider independent. And yet he never fell out of touch with me, and he's continued to stay in touch with me. And so when I started to do my record, I said, you know, here's this song that I think would be pretty for your voice. Will you do it? And he said, sure. And so when he showed up and sang that, and it was so gorgeous, and I thought, like, this is, you know, who could want anything more? This is like Christmas a million times over.
Closing the show is the beautiful song Scarecrow with Rufus Wainwright from Christian's Duets album, And. Thank you.
those who seek metaphor compare scarecrow that other man left.
It's Queer Voices.
The World Hepatitis Alliance tells us one in every 12 people on the planet are infected with hepatitis. Come join us on May 18th at Meridian Houston, 1503 Chartres, from 4 to 10 p.m. as the Heat Foundation and KPFT present Blues in Sea 2008. There will be food, giveaways, silent auctions, and you can listen to some great blues music by local artists like Sonny Boy Terry, Tommy Dardar, Steve Kreis, 98 in the Shade, and more, in honor of the first ever annual World Hepatitis Day. There will be no cover charge, and with free hepatitis screening on site, you can find out if you are number 12. For more information, log on to heatfoundation.us or kpft.org. KPFT Houston.
Join KPFT on Monday, May 19th, when we share the voice of a man who changed the world.
If violence is wrong in America, violence is wrong abroad. If it's wrong to be violent, then it's wrong for America to draft us and make us violent abroad in defense of her.
Beginning at 10 a.m. on Monday, May 19th, KPFT will commemorate the life and times of freedom advocate Malcolm X. During this day-long celebration, we will all get an opportunity to contribute to the effort to preserve the voice of Malcolm X and support the station where voices like his are honored and shared for new generations. Don't forget to join us on Monday, May 19th, for a day-long celebration of Malcolm X right here on 90.1 FM, KPFT, Houston.
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.